Hey guys, it's Albert. It may be May. We got plenty to get to this week. We'll cover all the big news topics and the takeaways. We've got a great guest coming on who's going to give us awesome insight on a couple of hot button topics. And as always, we'll get to all your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Normally this time of year, things would be quiet and it would stand to reason, given that everything that's going on in our country, it'd be really quiet from an NFL standpoint. We actually have plenty to get to this week in the podcast. We got a great guest coming up for you who's going to be able to hit on a couple of really relevant topics for us and give us a ton of expertise on those. We, of course, get to your questions in the mailbag, but we'll kick things off with the takeaways like we always do. And we'll start here. My first takeaway is that the NFL's trial balloon on incentivizing diversity hires didn't go, I think, the way they expected it to. And, you know, the feedback that I got from different guys across the league when it came to this and when the news broke, and it was Jim Trotter from NFL Network that broke the news on Friday afternoon, was very, very mixed. And just in case you haven't heard it, the proposal that was on the table, and this was worked through the NFL, the NFL's diversity committee, which is chaired by Steelers owner Art Rooney, the Fritz Pollard Alliance, which is headed up by former Cardinals general manager Rod Graves. They came up with this plan to incentivize diversity hires, and basically there are different levels at which teams can benefit here. If you hire a minority general manager, your third round pick the year after moves up 10 spots. If you hire a minority head coach, it goes up 6 spots in the third round. Your third round pick moves up 6 spots. If you hire guys into both positions, then your draft pick in the third round improves by 16 spots. If those guys last for 3 years in the third year, you get a 5-spot improvement for your general manager in the fourth round. You get a 5-spot improvement for your head coach in the fourth round. If you hire a minority quarterbacks coach, you get a 4th-round comp pick. If you have one of your own guys hired, you get a 3rd-round comp pick. If you have one of your own guys hired into a coordinator role, you get a 5th-round comp pick. So it's complicated the way all of this works. And when I asked around on Saturday and Sunday about this, some guys were flat out insulted by it and thought that it shouldn't need to come to this and that this wasn't going to do anything. And I agree with that. Like, I think there aren't very many owners that were going to be making a head coach hire, be making a general manager hire, and sit there and think about their 3rd-round pick. Like, this just isn't going to happen. And so, to me, I thought that there was just sort of this public relations kind of bent to the rule. And, I mean, look, if this leads to more conversation, that's good. But most guys I talked to didn't think this was the right way to go about it. In fact, and we're going to get to this with our guests, but I really, you know, the biggest thing that most of the guys I talked to thought was the problem and has been the problem when it comes to the general manager and the head coach hires, which owners are involved in, was the owner's comfort level with hiring minority candidates into those positions. And so, you know, one of the things that I kind of proposed in the Monday column was finding ways to get more minority candidates, more minority offensive coordinators and defensive coordinators, more minority college scouting directors, pro scouting directors in front of the owners. So then when they interview them, they've got a better comfort level with those guys. And it has been pointed out to me repeatedly that so many of the guys that have become general managers that are minorities were promotions from within. Some of the recent ones, Ray Farmer in Cleveland, Sashi Brown in Cleveland, Andrew Berry in Cleveland this year, left for a year and came back. Chris Greer in Miami is another one. And so it felt like the intention was good here, but they missed the mark a little bit on how they pulled it off. And I don't think it really helps anybody. Takeaway number two, I do think there was a positive that came out of this. And this measure isn't specifically a diversity measure, but the idea that the NFL is now going to step in and stop teams from blocking guys from moving up the ranks is a good one. Basically, and I'm not going to go through all the details of this one, but basically this is going to prevent teams from blocking guys who are further down the totem pole on the personnel side. It's going to prevent them from blocking those sorts of guys from interviewing for the number one or the number two spot on the person in the personnel department with another organization. Additionally, it is going to prevent teams from blocking position coaches from interviewing for coordinator jobs, which would routinely happen over the years. And so there are guys that have been blocked repeatedly. There are guys that I think will benefit from this. There are a few guys that probably would be coordinators right now. The Chiefs quarterbacks coach, Mike Kafka, certainly an example of that. The Ravens quarterbacks coach, James Urban, another example of that. Mike McDaniel, the run game coordinator in San Francisco, he'd be a third example of that. So I think that that definitely exists. And I do think that there are going to be some unintended consequences here to the way that all of this works. You know, number one, I think that it's going to maybe force some teams to push to promote guys that they were planning on waiting on promoting. So maybe that's Gerard Mayo, the linebackers coach in New England, becoming the defensive coordinator. Maybe it's Shane Bowen, the outside linebackers coach with the Titans, becoming the defensive coordinator there. I also think that this is going to put more pressure on sitting coordinators because head coaches know that now they've got the entire league available to them when it comes to position coaches as coordinator candidates. And so I think it does put some more pressure on the sitting coordinators. It'll be interesting to see the way this plays out because this will have a massive impact on the way that staffs are built, both on the personnel side and the coaching side, starting in 2021. Takeaway number three, you know, we've made a big deal out of the arrest this weekend or over the last week. And there were there's like a small explosion of them, right? So you had the situation with Quentin Dunbar, the corner from the Seahawks, DeAndre Baker, the corner from the Giants, Ed Oliver, the defensive tackle from the Bills, and then Cody Latimer, the receiver from the Redskins. Those four guys get arrested over the weekend. I don't know that it's necessarily indicative of a larger problem. If you look at the total number of arrests, it's actually down. It has stayed down over the last few years. The NFL has done a good job of sort of getting in front of these things and trying to do their best to get across to guys that there are ways that they can stay out of harm's way. This is a huge problem for the league a few years ago. My one takeaway from in this whole thing, though, when it comes to Dunbar and Baker and Oliver and Latimer, all four of those guys, and Dunbar and Baker got, you know, their arrests were in tandem. All four of these arrests involve guns. And so I think that there's something that the league probably wants to get to there. And I know that they've done some of this in the past. Maybe it's time to ramp up the education on that side a little bit. You remember there was a rash of DWI arrests a few years ago, and the NFL really tried to get in front of that. They strengthened the penalties against DUI. They, you know, added more sort of educational aspects to what they do in their off-season programs. I really think that the gun side of this, I think they at least have to take a look at that. Takeaway number four, Tom Brady's locked in. Tom Brady is 100% locked in, and I think we've seen signs of this over the course of the offseason, how he's been chomping at the bit to try to get as much work done as he possibly can. Obviously, there was the situation where he got kicked out of the park. There was a situation where he went to trying to go to Byron Leftwich's house, his offensive coordinator in Tampa, knocked on the wrong door. But the point is he was trying to go over to Byron Leftwich's house to get the playbook. And now we hear that he is going to and this was from the Tampa Bay Times, Rick Stroud reporting on this on Tuesday. He had eight of his teammates at Berkeley Prep, which is a high school in Tampa, working out. And among those guys, Mike Evans, star receiver, O.J. Howard, the tight end, who, you know, didn't have to show up, had been, you know, kind of a subject of trade rumors the last few weeks. He shows up. You have both his backup quarterbacks, Blaine Gabbert and Ryan Griffin, there. And this is great news for Bucs fans. This shows you a Tom Brady who's locked in again. He's done this with his guys in the past, and even like the last couple of years, as he skipped the Patriots OTAs, he had basically a workout camp in Montana, which, you know, Gronkowski had been there, Julian Edelman had been there. He'd done these extra things in the past. The fact that he's doing this now and going the extra mile to get this done now, I think, is a big positive. It shows how locked in he is. And I think we're going to get a focused Tom Brady in 2021. And again, you sort of look at the team that's going to be around him now. You know, Ryan Jensen, his center, was actually at this workout too. He's got Donovan Smith and Tristan Wirfs at the tackle positions.
You know, you look at the receiver spot, obviously we mentioned Mike Evans. On top of that, you got Chris Godwin, who's a rising young player. Tight end position is loaded with not only Howard, but also Cam Brayton, obviously Gronkowski. And, you know, they got a little bit more out of Ronald Jones, their second round pick of a couple years ago. I like the fact that they're doing the work now. I'd imagine that you might hear about a bunch of Buccaneers going to Montana in July ahead of training camp. It's going to be fast. I can't wait to see what Brady looks like in that offense. Finally, takeaway number five, facilities are reopening this week. I still think that it's unlikely that we'll see players in team facilities outside of maybe a little testing in June before the end of July. The one thing I had heard is that there's potential there to have maybe players back for a week in June. And I think the real aim of that would be to sort of test some protocols, see what happens when they get in the building, and try to like kind of get a feel for everything so you're not just doing everything at once in July. That makes some sense to me. I can't see allowing those guys to do anything organized with coaches in June. The main reason why is because of the inequities across the board. Mike Tomlin had talked about this a couple weeks ago. From team to team, I think you want to try to keep things as even as you possibly can, and you've got the luxury to do so right now. This isn't an essential part of the NFL calendar. When we get to July, that becomes a far more essential part of the calendar. This is not one, and to me, I look at like where the NFL has tried to keep the playing field level, and it was when they canceled the pro days, they didn't. I advocated this for a few days before they did it. I thought they should have done it faster than they did. But, you know, if certain teams were taking guys off the road, make sure it's not a competitive thing and make it a rule. Say we can't have pro days right now because of the circumstances. And eventually they did that so teams could make decisions based on the best interest, the health of their people. You know, now I think we're at the point where, you know, some teams would be okay to open. The problem is that, you know, if you do that, like, then, you know, what does that do to the teams that can't open? Do they do things out of bounds to make it happen? You don't want to make these things competitive. And so, I think you have to wait for right now. And, the stance they've taken, you know, until all facilities can open, no facilities can open. Well, you know, you've bent on that a little bit this week by allowing small groups of people into facilities. And, you know, you've allowed the reopening of some facilities. You know, the Falcons reopened their facility. The Colts reopened their facility. The Bengals are reopening their facility on Wednesday. Certain teams have done this and have started to reopen their facilities, but it's only business people going on in, and no one's got a problem with that. Where you create inequity between teams is if you start to allow not the coaches so much, but the players into the facilities. And so, you know, where the league has a chance to keep that playing field level right now, I think they've got to do it. And that means, I think is going to have to mean not opening facilities en masse, like allowing everybody in there and allowing everybody to do their work as normal, probably until it started training camp. The reason why, if you look at the timelines in states like Washington, where the Seahawks are, Jersey, where the Giants and Jets are, Massachusetts, where the Patriots are, the reopening timelines in those states make it so even like opening training camp on time, like it's going to require like these phases, like these dates not getting moved back. And so, you know, those teams know they're not going to be able to open fully until training camp. So you really can't allow other teams to do things where you're making, you know, you're creating some sort of competitive imbalance. Maybe you have to do that in July and August. You don't have to do it now, so you shouldn't. All right. So those are my five takeaways for the week, and we will get to our special guest right after this. All right, and so wanted to bring in this week somebody who I felt like would really be able to give us good perspective on what the next 9 months are going to look like in the NFL. And so went back and kind of thought about 2011, because that's what everybody wants to compare this to, the lockout in 2011. And not that they're exactly alike, but there are some similar circumstances here. And I immediately thought, okay, who did well that year? And you couldn't have done much better than the New York Giants did that year, winning their second Super Bowl in 5 years. And so I reached out to one of the top executives from that team, He spent 3 years at the Buffalo Bills, 8 years with the Eagles, 11 years as a Giants executive, two-time Super Bowl champion, and now an on-air analyst for NFL Network. It's Mark Ross. Mark, welcome in.
Great, Albert. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start here. What do you remember? I want to start at the beginning of 11. You know, and obviously you guys don't have much control over what's happening on the labor front. But, you know, you do have control over what's happening in your building. And I sort of wanted to start from the beginning in 11, where the planning for you guys began as far as, all right, this is going to be a different year and we got to start coming up with contingencies on the scouting side, on the coaching side. Overall, we know it's going to look a little different.
Well, yeah, as far as the coaching side, I mean, we had Coach Coughlin there and obviously well known for his preparation and readiness. And so I think for him, even though he probably was chomping at the bit just to be on field doing the OTAs and mini camps, that you know that he was 1,000% highly prepared for the season in any scenario that took place whenever the labor got settled. And that happened to be at the end of July. And it really, we just jumped right into training camp. From what I remember. So it really was on the fly. But with a guy like Coach Coughlin that you knew, no matter what the situation was, he was going to be ready. We had a real veteran staff. We had a veteran team. So I think it made that transition a lot easier for us as opposed to maybe some teams that had first-time head coaches or different quarterbacks. And I think you'll see that this year as well with the veteran staffs. The veteran teams will have an easier transition as opposed to those newer staffs, newer first-time head coaches.
Yeah, and I know one difference is that you guys actually couldn't talk to the players. So right. What do you remember about like just sort of trying to keep track of what was happening with your players? I remember some of these guys would organize passing camps. I'm sure Eli did one of those. That may have been the first year he had the guys down at Duke.
He kind of always did that Duke thing, and I think he kind of took that after what his brother would do. So I think for those guys, it probably was normal for them in their off season and just not being in the building. That was really the only difference. But as far as the off the field work that they would do together, Eli was always head and shoulders above that with his teammates.
What do you remember about camp? So you get to July and obviously it's sort of like, it's a rush because you guys are trying to sign draft picks. You guys are trying to get get free agents in. You guys are trying to, you know, arrange any trades you got to arrange. So you get that big rush of stuff from the personnel side. What do you remember about the first few days of camp and how different it was, you know, versus a normal year when you would have the 10 or even back in the day, the 15 weeks of run up in the spring?
Yeah, it's just everything was just so condensed and so much more fast paced. As opposed to, okay, this is your normal timetable. We can do this at this point. We do this week, do this the next week. With this, it just, from what I remember, was just we had to get our scouts in off the road. You know, they were always on vacation at that time anyway, get them in for camp and sign guys and just more sort of a chaotic type experience as opposed to normal years.
What do you think was there a point during camp where, and I don't know, I mean, maybe it was a practice, maybe it was a preseason game, maybe it was somewhere in a meeting room or something, but do you remember like a point in camp where you maybe thought to yourself, we're going to be okay? Like, despite the circumstances, despite this being hard on everybody, you know, we're going to be all right.
Yeah, again, I always thought that just because of the head coach that we had, the staff that we had, the players that we had back, a veteran team, and everybody was in the same situation. It wasn't as if that five teams had to do this and another five didn't and another 10 had half and half. Everybody was in the same situation. So it was all about the confidence that you had in your coaching staff, with your personnel staff, and how they worked together with the ownership. And I think that with our group, we had been together for so long that it kind of was just a seamless kind of transition. It wasn't just the head coach. It was the coordinators we had and position coaches who had also been there a while and had worked with Coach Coughlin, and we had been with those guys together. So I think it was a pretty seamless transition as far as what happened in our building.
Can you think of a tangible example where early, maybe, you know, in August or September of that year, where the experience having a quarterback, I think that was probably what Eli's eighth year, maybe. It's Coughlin's eighth year in the building. A lot of veterans on the coaching staff, like you said. Can you think of a tangible example somewhere in August or September where that showed up? Like the fact that you guys had that much experience and that much continuity in the building really kind of jumped out?
Well, I think, you know, we went down to Washington the first game of the year and we lost. And I remember Victor Cruz, that was his breakout year. And he dropped a couple balls early, but then he came back that 2 weeks later against Philly. And he caught that kind of short little out and took it. And then that's when the dance started and all. And I think that kind of, you know, we started out 6-2 and he had a phenomenal year. Akeem Nicks had a phenomenal year, Eli. So I think maybe that Philly game was the turning point. That was the third week of the season from what I remember when Victor kind of caught that short pass, took it to the house and did the salsa. And it kind of awoke in our season. It just gave us new life. It almost seemed like.
How do you think the nature of that year tests your team? Like, how do you think it tests? And I would assume the number one thing. This is just like my observation, but I would assume like one of the number one things is really kind of like the fact that the players are on their own. Maybe it tests the sort of person that you have in the building, right? Like the sort of player, like because the players are sort of on their own to do a lot of stuff, whereas you'd have them supervised for a big part of the spring otherwise. Where do you think that it really tested teams in 11? You know, the whole different setup and the fact that you guys didn't have supervision over the players, I mean, for the better part of 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Again, with our personnel department, we always try to bring in, you know, leaders and captains and guys that were motivated on their own, self-starter type of players. And again, we had a lot of vets with Eli and Bradshaw and Brandon Jacobs in the backfield. We had the David Deals and Chris Snees on the offensive line on the defense. We had Chris Canny and Justin Tuck, OCU Manura, and Antrell Roll in the secondary. So we had a lot of those veteran leaders. We had a lot of guys who were going to take ownership and make sure that just because they weren't around that they were still going to be a team and still be together and be 100% prepared whenever the season did start. So, you know, maybe some of those teams that weren't as veteran laden and didn't have such leadership might have struggled. And you might see that again, as I mentioned before, this year with who are those veteran groups, who has the leaders, who has the self-starters, who has the self-motivated players that can fight through adversity and these sort of situations.
Was your radar up for injuries? Because that was one thing I do remember, like that everybody was like a little concerned. Okay, they're going to be soft tissue injuries, or they're, you know, like, do you remember you guys all having maybe your radar up for injuries that year a little bit more than
in a
typical year?
I think for us it might have helped us just because Coach Coughlin was old school that when training camp started, it was grind, guys, grind them. Whereas with this, you kind of had to ease back a little bit and work into it a little bit slower just because of the time off as opposed to having your hands on them for the last few months and being able to see their progress. And then once they get to camp, just go at them. So I think for us, it helped us a little bit in that we had to kind of ease into it as opposed to, all right, we're here, let's go at it. We got 2-a-days and we're just going hard all the time.
So like it forced Tom to take his kind of his finger off the button a little bit then?
Right. Where it's just like, okay, well, let's get ready for the opening day. We're going to evaluate the players in camp and during the preseason games, but let's try to take care of the players a little bit more.
Was there anybody unsung in the building that was key that year? Was there anybody that you don't hear as much about that maybe was a key to kind of getting the team where it needed to be that year?
Oh, wow. I mean, I guess it's just a collective effort, really. Just everybody that was involved with it, the coaching staff, the trainers, the personnel department, getting the signings, getting the contracts done. It just everybody just seemed to work together. And you haven't been through a Super Bowl situation before, and you kind of know the mindset, you know, the selflessness that you have to work together in that aspect. And, you know, we started out the season 6-2, and I think that probably was a lot to do with it because of that. We hit a little bit of lull in the middle of the year, but then we obviously finished strong. But I think everybody just being on the same page, the one mindset, the one goal that we had helped bring everyone together.
and maybe it like highlight, like you mentioned those things that you guys look for in players. Maybe that stuff, like I said, maybe that stuff's more important, right? Like in a situation like that, like maybe that stuff, like what you were always looking for, maybe it was even like highlighted to a higher degree in a year like that one.
Oh, definitely. You know, when you're all as a team and you're together in a building, and you got a coach with you every step of the, every hour of the day, every minute of the day. Okay, go to this position meeting. Someone's on top of you. You go to the strength coach, they're on top of you. You go to the training room, they're on top of you. But when you're at home, no one's always checking in on you. No one can make sure they have their thumb on you. And that's where you really have to make sure that you have the self-motivation to take care of business and make sure that you maximize your effort and potential. And it is a lot harder when you're on your own as opposed to having the structure day in and day out of being in a building.
If you had if I'm a buddy of yours who's a head coach somewhere, if I'm a buddy of yours who's a GM somewhere who didn't go through 2011, and I asked you, what were the most important lessons you took from that year? And based on the weirdness of it, how different it was, how would you answer that? What advice would you give somebody if they asked you for advice on how to handle all of it?
Wow. You know, really just even work, try to just work more together. Just make sure that there's that support system with everyone in the building, that it's not just the coaches trying to do their thing, personnel, the ownership, that everyone is working towards the same goal and everyone is supporting each other and everyone is trying to come up with the best ideas and the best vision on how to proceed and make sure that everybody's on the same page to get the team prepared to play a season, not just get them prepared for week one, week two, or just preseason, that everyone's on the same page to make sure that you're on the goal to win the Super Bowl.
So I think that what you're saying is then, like the Saints with a coach and a quarterback who've been in place for a long time, the Steelers with a coach and a quarterback who've been in place for a long time, like teams like that, the Chiefs now, where Andy's been doing it forever, like
Ravens with Harbaugh, those sort of teams, I think it'll be much, much easier, much more seamless transition for those teams.
Okay. Before we get on to the next topic, do you have a favorite memory from that year? Like, do you have something that sticks out above all else from that year?
there was a ton of memories from that year, man. I mean, that was a magical year. But I think, man, you know, we started out 6-2. We hit the low. We got to the playoffs. Probably my favorite memory of that year was our wild card playoff game at home against Atlanta. You know, the 2007 season, we were on the road the whole time, so we didn't get a home game. And this was really our first home playoff game that we had. And then when Hakeem Nicks caught the little 5-yard in route, and then he just took it 60-some yards for the touchdown, and he just ran through the whole Atlanta secondary, and then he did the dirty bird in the end zone. I mean, Hakeem's one of my favorite players that I've ever been around. And just that moment at home after being on the road for so many other games, and I think that was just really probably the most special moment for me in all the runs.
Did that team surprise you guys at all? Like, just because, again, the circumstances, they were 9-7. I think I have that right. Right. Like, they were 9-7. Obviously, you know, it's a weird year and everything else. Did that team surprise you, or did you guys know all along that that team was capable of doing what it did?
Well, when you build the team, we felt like we had, obviously, the defense. We had a lot of stars on defense, a lot of defensive playmakers. As I mentioned, Justin Tuck and OC and Canty and JPP and Linval Joseph and Antrell Roll, Corey Webster. And then on offense, we had Eli, of course, back, but a young star and Akeem Nicks. We had the running game. So, you know, we thought we had a really good team going in. And you start out 6-2. You're like, okay, we're rolling. We're the real deal. And then I think we hit a four-game stretch in the middle. We lost four games in a row. And we ended up 6-6, and then we ended up winning three of our last four. You prepare your team. You're always going to have strengths and weaknesses on the team, but we thought we had plenty of strengths, and we had the formula and the blueprint to win with the defense, with a stable quarterback and some playmakers on offense that we thought we had a chance to compete against anybody, and we obviously showed that.
Okay. The one other thing I wanted to hit with you before we let you go, and it's Tuesday, so everybody out there that follows the NFL knows there was a policy or a proposal to incentivize minority hires that was tabled by NFL owners on Tuesday. They did pass an adjustment to the anti-tampering rules, which prevent teams from blocking young scouts from moving up, young and young coaches from moving up in the ranks. And Mark, I want to start with like the first piece of this, which was the draft pick incentive plan. And a lot of the guys I talked to over the weekend when this thing sort of first came to light were a little stunned, and the reaction I got was really mixed. I'm wondering, when you first saw it, whether it was on Friday or before that, what your first reaction was to it.
Yeah, I definitely was very surprised. And look, the NFL, the league office, have been trying for a while to make this right, to try to make it right, to make it fair. And that's what I think what all minority coaches and executives want, is just want it to be fair, somewhat of an equal playing field. And for that to come out where you almost have to bribe teams to interview candidates or hire candidates and get draft picks, it was very shocking to me. And I thought there had to be a better way. I think it being tabled, I think there was a lot of discussion, a lot of backlash, that this probably was not the right way to go about it. And we can think of better ways to try to make this right. So I think they will do that. I like the aspect of including more minority candidates in the interview pool. I mean, this doesn't necessarily mean they're still going to get hired. It still is going to come down to the owners. They're the ones ultimately making the decision, and they are the ones that still have to feel comfortable with the minority candidates. And that's what it really comes down to, in my experiences in the interview. I had 12 GM interviews, and after each one, the owners would say, "Oh, you did great. You're going to be a GM one day." We just felt more comfortable with the candidate that they hired. And that was the common refrain. And when you look at especially the black GMs or head coaches that have been hired by teams over the past 5-10 years, most of them have worked for the teams and then have gotten promoted to the general manager position. Jerry Reese, who I worked with the Giants for over 10 years, worked for the Giants. The two black GMs now, Chris Greer, worked for the Dolphins for years before they promoted him. Andrew Berry had already worked for Cleveland before they brought him back. And you can go on and on with the Martin Mayhews in the world who got promoted. So the owners have to feel comfortable. Unfortunately, and still, it's not about the qualifications. It's about the comfort level that the owners have to have with minority candidates. And I think the NFL is trying to make the steps to make sure that that happens.
Do you have an idea of how to fix that? Because, obviously that's that's such an intangible thing, right? Like, that's not something where you can just flip a switch and make it happen. So, I've had people bring up the idea to me, like, maybe there's a way to create like events where people can get in front of the owners. And I know there's no easy fix, but having been in so many of these interviews in the past, do you see is there some idea that's popped into your head that might be some sort of solution working to fix that issue?
Yeah, it's a shame that this is where we are, but this is what has to happen. It has to be the exposure and the meet and greets or seminars or with owners and minority candidates. And, non-minority candidates can get hired out of the blue just without having met the owners. But it's just that inherent comfort level that they have with non-minority candidates, unfortunately, still. But they just have to have the exposure and be in the building, unfortunately, to have the comfort or, off-season programs and meet and greet type of events that have to take place. Hopefully those sort of are the steps that may help. It's still not sure whether it will or will not help, but you have to try something in order to try to make it fair.
Was it personally frustrating for you to have to hear the same thing over and over again? Then you said you heard that a lot. I assume it have to be, because everybody's everybody's got goals, and your goal, like anybody on the personnel side, is to reach the pinnacle and become a GM. I'd assume like to have to hear that over and over again had to be tremendously frustrating.
Yeah. And Albert, I grew up in a working class black neighborhood outside of Philadelphia. parents always told me, as soon as I stepped out the door, they always sent me to the best schools. Just, you got to be twice as good. You got to be twice as good. And I've crafted a pretty good career. Just, you know, went to Princeton, went to grad school at UMass, and worked my way up pretty quickly in the NFL and two Super Bowls and whatnot. And it wasn't until I started interviewing for these GM jobs where at first it was just, I still thought it was just, okay, if I compete and I interview well and I present well, I'll get the job. But I soon had to figure out after about three or four of them that it was, well, wait a minute, I just might be being used here for the Rooney Rule, or just to get the minority candidate in there. And I could, we could have a whole nother podcast about some of the interview experiences that I had. But yeah, it got really frustrating. You personalize it a lot, and then you have to look at the big picture and say, well, geez, it's not just me. It's I mean, no one's done 12 like I have, but then you just look at the whole league, and it was really an epidemic, and you still see it to this day. And you know, unfortunately, minority candidates, whether it's head coach or GMs, I mean, they have to have unbelievably stellar and distinguished type of resumes in order to even get interviews. Whereas non-minority candidates, I mean, you look at the head coaching cycle last year with the Cliff Kingsbury having a losing record getting hired, Adam Gase had being just fired, getting a head coaching job, a Freddie Kitchens who hadn't had much experience, Zach Taylor. And if those were minority candidates, they wouldn't even be considered for interviews. So that's, those are the things that you have to kind of figure out how to even out those things where a minority candidate, we talked about Eric Bieniemy this year compared to, say, a Joe Judge's resume, where it was flipped, that Eric Bieniemy would definitely have a head coaching job. And if Joe Judge was a minority, would definitely not even be considered for interview for a head coaching position. So those are the things, the equality and the fairness that we have to figure out.
Have you been asked at all? Like have owners asked you at all? I'm just wondering, because I mean, they keep telling us in the media, this is a big topic for us. This is a big deal for us. Like, have they come to you at all to ask you?
Well,
about,
I think the league office really has taken it upon themselves to, you know, Troy Vincent and his group, along with Roger Goodell. I think they're the ones really are just spearheading it all and really feel offended by what's going on and really want to try to make a difference. I don't know if there's one voice for the owners or a couple of owners that are kind of driving the bus for them, but I know for sure that the league office is 100% trying to make this right.
Yeah, it's amazing to me because it's so like a guy I had a relationship. I've had a relationship with Andrew Hawkins, who, you know, played in the league for a bunch of years. And I remember him telling me a few times, like I want to be a GM. I want to be a GM. And, you know, he goes to grad school at Columbia, graduates, brilliant guy. And I don't know if you know him at all, but really, really smart guy, great personality, could definitely lead a room. And, you know, he's in the media now and he's doing his thing and everything else. But I'm just like, I look at him and I think to myself, like, why isn't some team just just knocking his door down to hire him? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Albert, we can go down the line, list of guys that, in the league with teams on the personnel side and on the coaching side who just get overlooked and don't get their chance. And it's just, you know, the league, again, going back to league office, they have a database and a executives and coaches who they feel are ready to go, and they're just being overlooked, and we have to make this change, and we have to identify these guys and give them opportunities. And it comes down to the owners, and no matter what type of things you put in place to try to help it, it all comes down to whoever that owner is making that decision. They are the ones that have to change their mindset and take a step to say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to hire the best guy, and not just discount minorities from that list.
Awesome. Okay. Well, hey, I really appreciate it, Mark. It's great catching up with you. He is a former Bills and Eagles personnel man, 11 years at Giants exec, two-time Super Bowl champion. Mark Ross, appreciate you coming out.
Great. Thanks, Albert. Take care now.
All right. Thanks to Mark Ross. He was fantastic. We're going to jump right into the six-pack. Normally, as you guys know, long-time listeners know, we'd have the mailbag here where we'd be answering email questions, we'd be answering voicemail questions. Unfortunately, we are now into 3 months of having to do it this way, which we're still getting great questions. Not the way we drew it up, but we're adjusting. Every week on Tuesday, I put the call out for questions you guys ask. I pick six. If I like your question and want to answer it on the podcast, I hit the little heart button, give you that like, and I give you an answer here. Question number one is from Don Ridenour, loyal listener, loyal reader at Don Ridenour. Who is going to have the best offensive line this year and why? So I actually kind of did a little research on this, Don, because we love you. We love your engagement and everything else. And I found two groups that I would normally kind of fall back on. And that's the Ravens, that's the Eagles, and I can't go with those two now because of the attrition there. Because the Eagles lost Jason Peters. I know he's been banged up over the last few years. Do you trust Andre Dillard to be the left tackle? That's an open question. And of course, the Ravens lose Marshall Yanda, who's been one of the best offensive linemen in the league, regardless of position, for a lot of years. And so both the Ravens and Eagles, I think, will be near the top, but maybe they get knocked down a peg. My honorable mention here will be the Indianapolis Colts, who I think have a chance to have a dynamite year up front. If you look at it, Braden Smith, Quentin Nelson, both those guys going into year three. You have Ryan Kelly, he's still on his rookie contract, and you have Anthony Costanzo coming back. It's just, that's an excellent group that's been able to grow together, and they should really be hitting their stride. So that's my honorable mention. My number one offensive line for 2020, though, give me the New Orleans Saints. All right, at the tackle position, you're outstanding. You got Teron Armstead, you got Ryan Ramczyk. You bring back Andres Pete on a long-term deal, and then inside, you're going to have two other guys that have a chance to be excellent. You have Eric McCoy, who was a great rookie last year, at the center position for you, second-round pick, and you're bringing in Cesar Ruiz from Michigan. So I love where the Saints are from an offensive line standpoint. They've put so much capital into that group. Teron Armstead, huge contract as your left tackle. Ryan Ramczyk, Cesar Ruiz, Andres Pete, all first-round picks, and then Eric McCoy was a second-rounder you traded up for. Give me the Saints. Question number two from Brian Schoberg. That's at Brian Schoberg. How will the NFL handle LA Chargers' half-empty, sparkly new SoFi Stadium? Brian, it's an excellent question. I don't know that they're going to have to worry about any fans being in that stadium this year. And so this actually, I think, creates an opportunity for the Chargers where there's not going to be as much attention on that element of things. And there's been so much attention on that over their first 3 years in LA, their first 3 years in LA, where everything was about what the stadium looks like, how many of the opposing fans are there, all that different stuff. Well, now they and the Rams go into this new stadium. They've got a rookie quarterback drafted in the top 10 in Justin Herbert. They've got a talented team coming back, a good coaching staff, a new offensive coordinator in a full-time spot for the first time. I look at everything there, and there's an opportunity here for the Chargers, even the uniforms. Everybody loves the new uniforms, right? So I think there's an opportunity there for the Chargers. Does it mean they're going to become the number one team in town? No. But I don't think the Rams are the Lakers or the Dodgers in town either. And so I think there's at least an opportunity there for them to capture some people. I don't know that they'll ever be able to, I don't know that they'll ever have a strong following in Los Angeles. And I do think the league has to understand, if they're planning on keeping the Chargers there long term, that there probably is going to be like a visiting fan element to everything that they do in that stadium for the foreseeable future. Question number three is from Jason Earl. That's at Hang Around Pod. The Texans have been one of the most interesting stories of the offseason. Sportsline has Houston's 2020 over-under at 8 wins. Are you taking the over or the under? The Texans have an incredibly difficult beginning to their schedule. And if they can make it through that part of the schedule, if they can make it through September and October, I think they'd absolutely hit the over here. I'm going to put them at 9 wins, so I'll give you the over. I think a lot of people have missed the boat on the Texans. Bill O'Brien's a much better coach than people give him credit for. And I think you look at the roster right now, and everybody wants to pay attention. Everybody wants to sort of focus on DeAndre Hopkins. The offensive line, the amount of capital they've put into that group, and you look at it, right? Like, and we just mentioned the Saints. All right, so you got Laremy Tunsil, who cost you 2 first-round picks at left tackle. You've got Titus Howard at right tackle. He's a first-round pick. You drafted Max Sharping, second-rounder, and you drafted Nick Martin a few years ago, and you've extended him at center. He's a second-rounder. And then you got Zach Fulton, who was a fairly big-ticket free agent addition. At every single position, they've put investment in. And I think the idea of Deshaun Watson playing behind a group like that, you don't need to be great at receiver. And they're more balanced at receiver than they have been. So, and that's with Cooks, that's with Stills, that's with, you know, that's with Randall Cobb. Like, they're more balanced than they have been. And so, you know, I think a lot of people look at, like, I have looked at the Texans and, you know, there are all these questions about what's going to happen with DeAndre Hopkins. I think that's a more well-conceived team than people realize. They're built strong up front. You know, they bring in Ross Blacklock to play on their defensive line. They would have drafted him, by the way, with the Tunsil pick. Like, that's how highly they thought of him. You add Blacklock to J.J. Watt. They've invested some in their secondary. I think that's a better team than a lot of people realize. Question number four, this is from Mike Duran. That's at MikeyD_31. Cam Newton to the Patriots. I guess that's a question. I don't think it'll happen before camp. But I think if Cam does decide to take the path here where he decides, okay, I'm going to wait until training camp and either somebody gets hurt or somebody doesn't like their quarterback situation, and then a week or two in, there's going to be opportunity for him. I think maybe that's where he'd be on the board for the Patriots, where maybe if they get 2 weeks into camp and they don't like what they see in Jared Stidham, they don't think that he can get them where they need to go, that maybe they would kick the tires on somebody like Cam. I think what's so interesting about Cam's situation, and I've said this a few times, is how it sort of illustrates the way that teams look at the starting quarterback and the backup quarterback as almost two different job descriptions. Obviously, your starting quarterback, you want to be as good as you possibly can be there. A lot of times, teams look at the backup quarterback and say, we don't want that guy to be competition for our starter. We don't want that guy pushing our starter. We want that guy being a resource to our starter. And if you look at the three teams right now that have young quarterbacks that weren't drafted in the first round that are sort of installed as the starters, all three of those teams have taken that approach in building their quarterback room. Denver with Drew Locke, Jacksonville with Gardner Minshew, and New England with Jared Stidham. All three of those teams have sort of built the quarterback rooms in a way that doesn't threaten the starter. So I think that that's by design in all three places. I do think the Patriots want to get a read on Jared Stidham, but if Bill Belichick decides a week or two in, we can't go forward with this, then certainly I could see him like taking a swing on somebody like Cam Newton. I just don't think it's happening right now. Question number four, this is from Ben Rorvik. At Ben Rorvik, what's the deal with Dak's contract? Does he play 2020 on the tag, or do one of the two sides say it cave to the other? After the draft, seeing the Cowboys' new offense, why doesn't he sign the tag now and get ready to play with the new coaching staff? Well, it doesn't make a difference right now, Ben, because they're not on the field. And I'm sure he's doing the work that he needs to do, and he'll be ready to go when he gets to the start of training camp. Ultimately, do I think this gets done? Yeah, I do, because the Cowboys have a long history of getting deals done with their star players. We've seen it, with the offensive line, Tyron Smith, Travis Frederick before he retired, Zach Martin, Lyle Collins. We've seen it on the defensive side of the ball. They take care of Jalen Smith. They've taken care of DeMarcus Lawrence. And so they've always taken care of their core players. I think that they will find a way to get this done with Dak. To me, the key might be the length of the deal. And if they're going to find a middle ground, the Cowboys need to bend somewhere. I don't think I think the raw dollars, like, they'll get where they need to be. I think that he will surpass what Russell Wilson got, because that's the sort of leverage that he has right now. The Cowboys would be smart to do this before the Chiefs can manage to do something with Patrick Mahomes. I think that, like, the key could be Dak. We're in an uncertain situation right now. We don't know what the cap's going to be going forward over the next few years. Let's do a Band-Aid deal. Let's do a 3-year deal or a 4-year deal. That way, you get your money now, and in 3 or 4 years, you'll be able to benefit from the new television deals. You'll be able to benefit from the influx of gambling money. You'll be able to benefit in a lot of different ways if you're willing to play ball with us now. And so I think that that's the key. And maybe it's tough for the Cowboys to do that, because they did a long deal with DeMarcus Lawrence, because they did a long deal with Zeke Elliott, because they did a long deal with Jalen Smith. Maybe it's a little harder for Dak for the Cowboys to swallow that. But I think that they've got to bend somewhere, and to me, that's the most logical place to do it. Finally, question number six. This is from Kevin Farley. Is that six? That is six. Yes, that's six questions. From Kevin Farley, that's at KFarley21. Will the Jets sign Logan Ryan, and how quickly will Adam Gase be on the hot seat this year? Kevin, to your first question, I do think they wind up with Logan Ryan. It makes all the sense in the world. I think they're the only team that's willing to go financially where he wants to go, and get him at least to a point where maybe he can, through incentives, get to $10 million, which was his bar and how much he made the last few years. I think the flip side of this is that the market for him out there, and is, you know, where is the other team? Miami maybe being in the mix. They've invested so much in corner right now, and maybe they look at moving him to safety. But like, with what they've invested in Xavien Howard and Byron Jones in drafting a corner in the first round, I don't think that their investment is going to be massive in another defensive back. And so my guess is the Jets are the team for him, and he winds up signing there either sooner or later. Appreciate you guys coming out as always. You guys know where to find me if you have feedback for the podcast. We're always looking for your feedback. We may bring Gresh back in for the takeaways next week. We just didn't have the time to do it this week, but I want your feedback on that too, how you guys liked last week's episode, where we did have Gresh in for the takeaways, something we've sort of toyed with the idea of doing to add another voice to the podcast every week. You guys know where to get me. I'm not hard to find on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. Then you guys know where to find this podcast also. And if you hit the subscribe button there on my podcast, I'm part of the MMQB NFL podcast feed. That means you also get Gary's podcast on Monday mornings. You'll get the Week Side podcast with Connor and Jenny. You'll get our weekly wrap-up podcast that we've been doing periodically over the course of the last few weeks. You'll get the Gambling Podcast too, all in one feed. You can also get the MMQB news podcast. That's part of all of this too, but that's on a separate feed. So you just hit subscribe on the MMQB NFL podcast feed. You hit subscribe on the MMQB news feed, and I'm sure you guys have a way to find that. Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows, we're there. Same time next week. See you guys then.